Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we're joined by a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, welcome back.
Glad to be here, as always.
We're also joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. He has a very good piece, Dead Man's Hand, The Impeachment Gambit. You can find it in The Polemicist as well as Counterpunch, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Leon.
We're also joined by a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, as always, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Representative Rashida Tlaib says that she will not go to Israel after the country initially rejected her request for a visit, then Israel reversed course. Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from Michigan, said today that she would not travel to Israel under quote-unquote oppressive conditions to see her 90-year-old grandmother after the Israeli government reversed course and said it would allow her to make the trip. After initially banning her and Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, from entering the country, Israel relented earlier today in response to a request from Tlaib to see her grandmother, who lives in the occupied West Bank. Let's start with Daniel Lazar. Daniel, your thoughts on these recent developments?
Well, Israel looks very bad, certainly. It's kind of brought to light what kind of country the U.S. is dealing with. I mean, where any American Jew with no ties at all whatsoever to Israel can go there and claim citizenship. But Rashida Tlaib has grave difficulty in visiting her own grandmother in Israeli-occupied territory because she is not Jewish. So that's outrightly discriminatory, it seems to me. And Israel's, you know, kind of flailing around on the topic doesn't make it look any better. So I think Americans now have a better sense of what kind of country Israel is, and that is a profoundly discriminatory, racially or ethnically oppressive state, and one which is committed to a concept of Jewish supremacism, which I dare say is contrary to what most Americans believe in, whatever, you know, all this country's shortcomings notwithstanding.
Caleb Maupin, Donald Trump had either called or tweeted Prime Minister Netanyahu telling him that Israel needs to stand strong and not allow Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar into the country. In my opinion, Israel not allowing those two women in actually makes them look pretty weak. I mean, if your game is strong, if you are confident in your stand, you should be able to take all comers. And if you can deal with the PLO, you can't deal with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib? I think it makes them look pretty weak.
Well, you know, I think these two freshman congresswomen signify a very important shift in the country. Because the amount of Americans at this point, people living in the United States, U.S. citizens who practice Islam, is much larger than it's ever been before. And especially for the Democratic Party, which tends to be the party representing urban areas, whether it be Chicago, Boston, New York City, Detroit. You know, I mean, the number of Americans that feel the way, you know, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib feel about Israel is not small, and it's growing. And the Democratic Party needs to make it clear that folks with their perspective have a place in the Democratic Party. And I think that that's the role that they are very much playing. And it shows that the issue of Israel is increasingly becoming a polarizing one. It used to be that support for Israel was just kind of guaranteed in the U.S. political establishment. Whether you were a Democrat or a Republican, it was just kind of assumed that you were a supporter of Israel. But it seems that at this point, it's very much becoming Republicans who very loudly beat the drum of being pro-Israel. And while most Democrats are pro-Israel to some degree, the Democrats tend to be slightly critical of Netanyahu. And now we see the Democratic tent opening wide enough that you can have Rashida Tlaib, you can have Ilhan Omar, and you can have their very strong criticism of Israel has a place in the Democratic Party. And I think this points to the changes in the demographics of the United States, as well as a kind of widening of the Democratic Party tent. And I think that's very interesting. I understand that Israel generally has a policy of banning from entering the country those who advocate boycotting it. But what is interesting is it almost seems like, this was very much this whole arrangement with Trump tweeting out that they shouldn't be allowed to visit the country, I believe, and then initially being banned, and then now, well, she's going to go visit her grandmother. Okay, well, we'll allow her to go visit her grandmother. This is all public relations. This is all smoke and mirrors. No one wants to look like the bad guy here, and if someone's banned, they can be the victim. If the ban is then lifted, someone can be very, willing to let even a harsh critic come in as long as they can visit their elderly grandmother. This is a lot of PR. This is Washington politics. This is smoke and mirrors. That's kind of how I see this whole controversy.
Jim Kavanaugh. So members of Congress were putting together a delegation to go take a trip, and they weren't actually going to meet with any either Palestinian or Israeli officials. As I understand it, the original intent was they were going to basically do a fact-finding mission. So you've got members of the legislative branch that were going to take a trip. Now the head of the executive branch decides that he wants to interject into the process, which to me, it's not a constitutional violation of separation of powers, but it is theoretically to me as such. And I'm disappointed but not surprised that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, hasn't stepped to the mic and defended her members by telling Netanyahu, hey, buddy, the next time you want to come here, as long as I'm Speaker, this house is closed.
Well, that would be an interesting response. It's certainly the case. Well, first of all, what Kellen said is very important. This is now becoming an issue in the Democratic Party in a way that it hasn't been before, and nobody can take for granted the support of Israel. Although the Democratic Party as an institution is completely and 100% supportive of Israel and is going to try to quash any radical criticism of Israel as an apartheid state or ethno-nationalist, ethno-religious supremacist state, as Daniel quickly, I think, described it.
Mm-hmm.
And that the standard congressional tourist trip did go forward. I think there was a picture yesterday of these congresspeople posing with Israeli missiles. So, that's the official congressional support of Israel, Democrat and Republican. And the idea that Trump intervened in this is quite interesting and radical in its own right in terms of American political etiquette between the Congress and the president, not only between the Congress and the president, but between the president standing up, just trying to prevent Congress people from getting into another country. I mean, this is the guy who's Make America Great Again, who's a big American nationalist, and he's defending, trying to prevent American elected Congress people from going to another country. And this is, as Bernie Sanders said, well, if Israel wants to prevent, we give Israel millions of dollars, hundreds, billions of dollars. Maybe we should start thinking about that if they're not going to let American congressmen into the country. This is kind of outrageous that America would put up with this from anybody. But of course they do from Israel. And the idea that Trump got himself out in front of it is completely outrageous. But we are going to see pushback on this. And there was an interesting little, even Tlaib herself and Ilhan Omar have been walking the tightrope about BDS. I mean, they support BDS, but Tlaib had said, okay, she had written a letter, I think, to the Israeli ambassador saying, well, I will go in and I'll promise not to say anything about BDS.
Right.
And then she thought better about it and said, no, I will not let myself be silenced. Why should Israel silence this woman to go back to her own home to visit? This is outrageous. She's not an immigrant to Israel, to Palestine. She's someone whose parents lived there. And this is, I think, highlighting for Americans, I hope, in a way that hasn't been before. This will open the door to highlight the sense in which Israel is an ethno-religious supremacist state. It's an apartheid state. People who are the native population of the country are not allowed to go back there, while, as Daniel said, you know, any Jewish person in the world can go there whenever they want. Of course, the Israelis even are stopping it. They're stopping some critical Jews from going back there. You know, Noam Chomsky would have a problem getting in Israel now, and Norman Finkelstein and Richard Falk. So even now, Israel has to prevent critical Zionist or anti-Zionist Jews from going in, while they allow right-wing anti-Semites to go, Semites to go in all the time. So it's highlighting things that I think are going to be interesting to see how they develop in the American political atmosphere.
The only issue I'll take, Jim, with what you said is, I think they'd let Norman in. I don't think they'd let Norman out. A final point on this to you, Daniel Lazar, and then if anybody else wants to comment on it. And this kind of follows up on to what Caleb was talking about. Israel's decision to initially prevent their entry drew widespread criticism from an incredibly diverse group of people in this country, Democratic lawmakers and American Jewish organizations, including AIPAC. And I just found that to be really, really surprising that AIPAC was standing up and being as vocal as AIPAC is on this issue.
Well, I mean, Israel is ruled by a far right government. That's the way things are, and they're to the right of AIPAC. Hard as it is to believe, you know. And one thing that Jim said is very important. I mean, Israel is not only an ethno supremacist, ethno Jewish supremacist state. But you have to bear in mind that in Greater Israel, that is the total area ruled by Israel, which would include Gaza and the West Bank, Jews are now a minority. So Jews, therefore, are increasingly a special ethnic religious caste ruling over the rest of the country. And the more they slip into minority status, the more those numbers change, the more pronounced that the quality of that ethno-religious dictatorship will become apparent.
Can I add something?
Yeah, go ahead, please, Caleb.
You know, I want to just touch on the fact that, you know, Rashida Tlaib, she represents Michigan in the U.S. House of Representatives. And the fact that she, you know, as an Arab American woman, is now representing Michigan in the House of Representatives, and the fact that she is taking criticism of Israel very publicly and from her office is criticizing Israel, that's decades in the making, right? You can go back 30, 40 years to the formation. There was a formation in Detroit called the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM. And it was a group of African-American auto workers who felt like the United Auto Workers, UAW, in Michigan, in Detroit, didn't represent them properly. And it was like a dissident faction in the union. And this was back in the 1970s. And they very famously joined with a lot of the Arab American auto workers. At that point, the highest concentration of Arab Americans was in Dearborn, Michigan, near Detroit. And they joined with them and very famously opposed Israel during the 1970s. And it made them very widely hated and very widely condemned. The fact that this group of African American auto workers, the fact that, you know, they were joining with the Arab American auto workers and opposing the UAW's position of supporting Israel and doing so very vocally. And they were very much in the minority, and they were very, very hated for doing that. But the fact that public opinion in Michigan has changed so much that not only is Rashida Tlaib elected, but from her office representing Michigan, she is opposing Israel. That shows that things in the United States have really, really changed. And I think that you can't really miss the importance of this. You know, that in the 1970s, it was a fringe far-left group within the UAW that criticized Israel. Now that seems to be, in her district, probably majority opinion. That's big.
I'd like to say something else also, which is important.
Sure.
The fact that Trump did this, said what he said, which is outrageous. But it's being used by the defenders of Israel in the Democratic Party to try and say, blame this on Trump. David Frum tweeted out today that the Tlaib Omar story is only incidentally about Israel. It's about a flagrant abuse of presidential power. It's made in America. It's a made in America scandal by Americans for Americans. That's the way they're going to try and use this as, oh, this is Trump's fault. Trump was the one who got this. Netanyahu didn't want to stop them from coming in, but Trump told them to do it. And it's not about Israel. You know, it's about Trump. And that's really going to be the way. I've seen it already on MSNBC and a lot of people saying, oh, you know, yeah, it, this is an abuse of the of presidential power by Trump, and it's certainly an outrageous statement by Trump. But Israel, this is a problem of Israel that Trump, again, is not the source of. He exacerbates it, but he's a symptom, not the problem.
Here's the next question for you guys. Is a recession on its way? Is it already here? If it's on its way, how bad will it be? Prognostications vary, and we don't have the great data to predict future events, but we've got plenty of data on the past. And the indicators are that a recession is on its way. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts?
Well, if you want to look at how vulnerable the U.S. economy is right now, you have to look at shale, right? Because Trump is going around boasting about the USA as an energy superpower. We're, you know, churning more oil and natural gas out than ever before. But if you read what's being written in the New York Times by economists, read what's being written in the Wall Street Journal, there is a basic consensus, you know, among economists now that if the oil price significantly decreases, that will result in a very, very dramatic crash because the shale industry, yes, they're churning out lots of oil, lots of natural gas, but they're doing it all on credit. And they're even with things going well as they are, even with the oil price, you know, staying, you know, around $50 a barrel, even now they're having trouble paying back their loans to banks, right? They're doing it all on credit. All this money is being pulled out of all this oil is being pulled out of the ground and it's being pulled out on credit from banks. And the shale industry, which is a huge factor now, its ability to functionally do business is in widely in question. And if there was a drop in the oil price, the results could be catastrophic, right? There was a very significant oil price drop under Obama. It had some bad results. But if that were to happen today, the shale industry is so much more vulnerable than it was before. And I think that factor can't be overlooked. The other thing is that you know, Trump, he continues to go on about, oh, you know, it's an economic miracle and all of that. It's not an economic miracle for average Americans. Their standard of living is not going up. It's just not happening, right? And the spending power of average Americans has decreased. The rate of household debt is very high. And in fact, mortgage debt at this point is higher than in 2008 when it had reached a very high point. The U.S. economy is very, very vulnerable right now. It may be doing well in terms of growth, but it's very vulnerable. There are a lot of very, very weak points. And if one thing goes down, the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. It's very scary to watch.
Did any of the three of you happen to see Peter Navarro this morning on CNN?
No.
Okay. Well, let me just say this. The way that CNN has been totally disrespecting Donald Trump's economic advisors, they refer to Larry Kudlow as a guy who's a fake economist or who's playing an economist on television. They refer to Peter Navarro as the most disrespected economist in the country. No economist of any repute respects Peter Navarro. I mean, they're just totally, totally disrespecting his and Navarro comes on today and says, no, there's not a recession coming. Oh, no, that inverted curve, it was actually flat. No, that's not a problem. I've written a number of books on this issue, and I know what I'm talking about. Daniel Lazar, one of the things about where we are right now in terms of personal economics is a lot of people are financing their lives on debt. Consumer debt is up. Yes, wages are up, but when you adjust wages for inflation, wages have only gone up by about 1%. To Caleb's point, the president wants to keep talking about how strong the economy is, but as Rasmus always points out, that's in a financialized economy. That means that the financial institutions are doing well. Corporations are awash with cash, but they're not buying factories, they're not buying machines, and they're not really increasing production, which then produces jobs, which then increases wages.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's been 11 years since the great crash of 2008, and growth since then has been very, very weak. And at the same time, the central bankers led by the Federal Reserve have pumped out liquidity, that is cash and credit, onto the markets at unprecedented rate. And still, the patient is no better than semi-comatose. Now, if a recession does hit, I would think that the ruling class should be very, very afraid, because they have blown all their they've used their arsenal up. They have very little ammunition left in their holster, whatever the hell it is. So therefore, the U.S. deficit is already shooting through the roof. If a recession hits, it'll expand dramatically. You're right that wages have been very weak. They've been stagnant. And what's really killing workers is real estate inflation, which has led to a tremendous increase in housing costs. And that is a direct consequence of the qualitative easing, the super pump priming the Fed has engaged in, which has caused an asset explosion on the stock market and in real estate. So if the recession hits, this will all come to an end, and the financial authorities have less and less left with, you know, in terms of weapons to deal with this problem. So that means a crunch. And think of the consequences politically. Over the last 10 or 11 years, we've seen a dramatic political weakening. I mean, huge structures have come crashing down. The UK is the most, the United Kingdom is the most obvious, but the US is also under severe political strain. We have near civil war conditions in Hong Kong, et cetera, et cetera. So if a recession hits, all this will intensify dramatically. And so therefore, the political crisis, which is already acute, will grow much worse. So it's going to be a very hairy situation.
Jim Cavanaugh, the political hairiness I was going to bring to you, if this projected recession hits, and it may very well hit before the election, what does Trump run on? I mean, if he's running on racism, xenophobia, and a faux economy, and his faux economy gets exposed for being the phonus, and I made up a word, that it is, man, how much worse can it get?
No, it would be very bad for him politically. I was hoping when you said you'd give me hairiness, would include some hair. But no, it would be very bad for him politically. And clearly, he is desperate to avoid this. That's why he's hectoring the Federal Reserve Board to lower interest rates. I don't think that's going to do much good. They're pretty low anyway, historically speaking. And that's the only tool they have, as people have been saying. You know, they're running out of tools on this. And what they did before with Obama was the quantitative easing, was pouring liquidity in by buying bad assets, buying these bad financial assets, the mortgage-backed securities and things like that. You know, as people pointed out, Caleb, I think, pointed out, you know, the situation is worse in terms of mortgage debt. It's terrible in terms of student debt. It's auto debt, auto loan debt. All of these things have increased, and people are up against it all the time. That's why whatever the 1% wage increase versus the 300% increase in CEO salaries, you know, isn't really helping the average American. The gross figures on gross domestic product don't mean anything in people's real lives. And that's not going to get much better. And if it gets appreciably worse, and there's some dramatic public, you know, this makes a difference, whether there's some kind of big corporation that goes under and, you know, 50,000 jobs are lost, or the stock market plunges 20%. These are public things that make it very bad politically. And something like that, you know, it may very well happen. I don't know what'll probably happen. And the tools that they have to deal with it just aren't there now. And in fact, Trump is weakening the United States economy in the terms of, you know, the Chinese now are saying we're not going to buy any agricultural products from the United States. Not only next week, but forget it. You know, we're making long-term contracts now with Russia for soybean. So American farmers are now going to have to get bailed out by the federal government because they're going to be overproducing soy and they're not going to have any market for it. So all of these things are happening. I think there's a level at which there's some people in the ruling class who wouldn't mind adding to Donald Trump's troubles next year. But that's another issue.
In fact, to your point about farmers, Peter Navarro, one of the things that, and I was really disappointed in CNN this morning because they did not push back on him nearly to, they just let him spew a whole bunch of ignorance and foolishness. To the farmer piece, he said, "We're making the farmers whole." And that went by without even a giggle. I was really shocked when he said, we're making them whole. And nobody said, but no, you're not. And if you even if you were making them whole, you're not making them whole. I mean, you would be making them whole at the expense of the American taxpayer. So one more point, and then I know somebody wanted to, was that Daniel that wanted to make a comment? Let me just say one more thing. When you talked about the Federal Reserve doesn't really have any more arrows in its quiver, because what the prime rate is, what, 2.1%. So they have very little cushion to cut rates. But here's the other thing that I think always has to be stated when that point gets made. And that is, even if they did cut rates down to zero, make money totally free, because of the financialized nature of the economy, corporations, as I said earlier, they're not investing in equipment. They're not buying factories. They're buying back stock. They're paying their executives exorbitant salaries and bonuses. So they're not investing or reinvesting that money back into the real economy that winds up creating jobs for people. And so I think that's the other part of that Federal Reserve point that always has to be realized, is that the nature of the American economy has changed. We don't make anything anymore. So Donald Trump talking about bringing these jobs back, no, they're just buying more stock and paying dividends to their shareholders. Daniel Lazar.
Okay, I just wanted to say that that Trump will not be without resources if a recession hits. He'll play the blame game. So who will he blame for the recession? He could blame China. He could blame the EU, certainly. Domestically, he has a very rich, it's a target-rich environment, right? He can blame Rashida Tlaib. He can blame Ilhan Omar. He can blame Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He can blame larger groups, such as Black people, such as Hispanic people. So it could get really, really ugly very fast.
And that was the basis of my question to Jim when I said, if he has a faux economy to run on and he runs on xenophobia and racism and his faux economy gets exposed, what's he got left? And that was the basis of my question. You're absolutely right. Go ahead and finish. I'm sorry.
And so he would just double down and ramp up the xenophobia and the racism. And so for me, the big question is, how will the Democrats respond? If they've been silent over this incredible, provocation involving Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, then they may not be very vigorous when it comes to combating Trump's efforts to blame other groups for the recession. And we all know what groups he will seek to blame.
Another thing Peter Navarro said was, he just threw out, well, China's a currency manipulator. They're manipulating their currency. And nobody said you're wrong. Nobody said you're stupid. Nobody said, no, that's not what's happening. That China allowing its currency to drop based upon the market forces as a result of these tariffs, that's not currency manipulation. That's just China letting the market forces do what market forces do. But nobody pushed back on Navarro, and I was really disappointed. Hey, folks, it's Friday. It's panel time. We got Caleb Maupin. We got Jim Kavanaugh. We got Daniel Lazar. This is The Critical Hour. More on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday, so that means it's panel time. We've got Caleb Maupin, we've got Daniel Lazar, we've got Jim Kavanaugh. Before we went into the break, we were talking about the pending recession, and Jim Kavanaugh, you had one more point you wanted to wrap up that conversation with.
I just want to make the point, you say, and correctly, I think that the money that's been poured in, the liquidity that was poured into the system over the last recession did not go to people. It goes to the rich. It goes to wealthy institutions. It becomes the fuel for inflation in the asset sector, which makes rents go up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you see is if money went elsewhere, it would improve the economy. If they got rid of the student loan debt, that would all of a sudden put money in hands to people, for ordinary people to use, and that would help the economy. But that's not the way it's going to go. You know, it's not going to go to the private debt that people have for their day-to-day needs. It's going to go to save the banks and the wealthy who have invested in stupid speculative investments. Anyway, that's my thing.
How about that and a domestic Marshall Plan, so that we can deal with the lead drinking water in Flint, Michigan, and the lead drinking water in Newark is the most recent place now. If we went to a domestic Marshall Plan and student debt, we'd see the quality of life of Americans improve. Earlier in the week, Hong Kong protesters clashed with police at the Hong Kong International Airport. Protesters clashed with police in riot gear and armed with pepper spray in Hong Kong's main airport terminal earlier in the week, injuring a few people. The protesters and the police appear to be at a standstill at this point. Caleb Maupin, we'll go to you. What's really going on in Hong Kong and why?
Well, you know, it's funny because whenever people talk about this in the mainstream media, mainstream politicians, mainstream commentators, they want to make this about freedom. They want to make it about human rights. They want to make it about dictatorship and democracy. That's all a big smokescreen. That's not the issue here. What are they protesting about? They are protesting about the fact that basically Hong Kong at this point is trying to change its extradition laws. And the way it works is, you know, if I as a U.S. citizen went to Hong Kong, as a U.S. citizen broke the law in the United States and went to Hong Kong, Hong Kong would then extradite me back to the United States to stand trial. If a citizen of Australia went to, if someone broke the law in Australia, then went to Hong Kong, Hong Kong would extradite them back to Australia to stand trial for their crime. And Hong Kong is part of the People's Republic of China. It has a different political system. It's one country, two systems, but it's part of the People's Republic of China. And they want to change the law so that if someone breaks the law in the Chinese mainland, that Hong Kong will extradite them to the Chinese mainland to stand trial. And that's the issue here. And if you read the statements from these protesters, you read the statements from people supporting them, the concern is explicitly about the business community. There are a lot of wealthy people in Hong Kong who want the right or the ability to go break the law in the Chinese mainland and never be taken to court or face any penalty for it in the Chinese mainland. Well, that's ridiculous, right? Especially because Hong Kong is part of China. This isn't another country you're extraditing them to. You're extraditing them to the same country. And it's not for crimes they committed in Hong Kong. It's for crimes they would have committed on the Chinese mainland. And this is about defending the right of the wealthiest people in Hong Kong to basically have immunity from any crime that they might commit or be accused of committing on the Chinese mainland. And it's absurd and it's humiliating. No country in the world would allow such a thing. We wouldn't set up a situation where Chicago, you know, if you commit a crime in Detroit, you know, but you're from Chicago, well, they handle it in Chicago. They do, you know, they take care of it in Chicago. I mean, no, we extradite people all the time. I mean, it's just basic. This is the right of China to extradite people within its own country that's being sacrificed here. And it's about defending the right of big, wealthy interests in Hong Kong that are tied to big, wealthy interests in the United States, big, wealthy interests in Britain, so much so that we see the protesters unfurling the flags of the United States, unfurling the flags of Britain, the former colonizer. This is extremely ridiculous. Are there issues with human rights in both Hong Kong and the Chinese mainland? Of course. Are there issues with democracy and representation? Do they need reform? Of course they do. That's not the issue in these protests. And I must say, imagine if people were doing this in American airports, right? I mean, imagine that people in American airports were behaving this way. The response would be swift, people would be arrested, and that would be the end of it, right? And the fact that you know, people are in airports beating up people, engaging in violent confrontations with police, preventing flights from taking off, I mean, this would not be tolerated in the United States. But we expect the Chinese government to just sit back and allow this to take place. The double standard in American media is shocking.
It's not only a double standard, Jim Cavanaugh. As I understand it, the way that this issue has been presented through mainstream American media, it's been presented as though China is trying to impose the extradition law on Hong Kong. But as I understand it, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, was the one who initiated or proposed the initial law. And the other thing is what Caleb just laid out is very accurate, but it's not a hypothetical issue. There have been some fairly gruesome murders that have taken place.
As Caleb is saying, this law, this extradition law, is a relatively minor change in extradition procedure, which would be normal in any other situation. But what the American media is trying to do is treat Hong Kong as an independent country, you know, and what they're trying to do at the outset, you know, and there are a lot of people in let's say at the outset, a lot of people in Hong Kong who are afraid of a more repressive atmosphere in terms of political rights, insofar as they're assimilated into China. But guess what? They're going to be assimilated into China. Hong Kong is a part of China. And what the Western powers and the United States has said, it's put millions of dollars into this through the National Endowment for Democracy. The leaders of the movement have met with American embassy personnel. They carry American flags and British flags and sing the American national anthem. They beat up the guy in the airport on the stretcher as he was being taken out of the airport with an American flag. So it's a very bizarre situation that it indicates a lot of problems with the ideologies that are circulating in the world about what represents democracy and what doesn't. But at the end of the day, what the Americans are trying to do is to create a situation where there's a pressure for secessionism, essentially, in Hong Kong. And there are people in Hong Kong who want that. And I think it was started, to a large extent, ultimately by the business community, who are afraid of being charged with corruption and being extradited to the mainland. But it's snowballed in another way that's very dangerous now. And it's also, of course, been hijacked, I think, by the fact that the American ideological apparatus around the world through the NED, et cetera, has money and support and gives material support to these people who feel they're doing something on behalf of democracy.
And Daniel, the National Endowment for Democracy, again, as we see these students and protesters waving American flags and singing the national anthem, and somehow we're supposed to believe that this is some organic Hong Kong movement? I don't think so.
Yes. I mean, first of all, let's step back a second. I mean, China is a country of grave contradictions and in serious trouble. Debt is through the roof. Its economy is faltering, even though its growth figures are two or three times that of the most Western countries. But its economy is slowing down, and they have this, and it is in some sense a communist worker state, but it has a huge capitalist sector. So you have this strange situation where billionaires, you know, sit in the central committee of the Communist Party and pledge fealty to Marx, Engels, Stalin, and Mao. It's a very strange, it's really a head-spinning situation. And then in 97, China then kind of semi-absorbed a capitalist enclave of Hong Kong. Now, all these 30 years or longer of these contradictory, seemingly impossible policies are not now finally breaking down. So China's got to figure out, what does it do? How does it prevent a social explosion? How does it keep the economy afoot? What does it do with a place like Hong Kong, a major world financial center, which seems to be sort of like, you know, in the grips of a major secessionist movement? How does it contain all these problems? The CIA is mounting a major propaganda offensive regarding Chinese treatment of their Muslim minorities and the Western China. So China is under intense pressure. It's under growing assault by the U.S. and other Western capitalist states. So how is China going to handle this problem and the problem of its own collapsing economy and its own resurgent capitalist sector, which it doesn't really know what to do with? So that's the issue they're facing.
Final point I want to get through quickly before we wrap this whole thing up. And gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today. The Trump administration is planning to sell $8 billion in fighter jets to Taiwan, which is angering China. The Trump administration is trying to move ahead with selling F-16 fighters to Taiwan. And the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee, they're going to review this package. They're not expected to raise objections. And that, to me, speaks volumes. Caleb Maupin.
In the 1990s, the Chinese Communist Party's leadership, Jiang Zemin, announced that their eventual goal was to adopt the Western liberal democratic system and that they were moving China toward that goal. Now, as you can see, the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party expressing itself with President Xi Jinping, that has been completely reversed. They no longer strive to move toward a Western liberal democratic system. In fact, they are furthermore developing socialism with Chinese characteristics and emphasizing the revolutionary foundations of the People's Republic. And part of the reason that there has been such a shift ideologically within the Chinese Communist Party is realizing that no matter how accommodating and friendly and open China is toward Western capitalism, hostility toward their economic growth and expansion will perpetuate. And this, you know, the fact that the USA is sending weapons to Taiwan, what's happening now in the Hong Kong airports, shows that, you know, China could bend over backwards, China could change its flag to the American flag, but Western capitalism would still be hostile to it, would still want it to remain an impoverished country. And that realization has forced China to reassert some of the Marxist-Leninist ideology and long-term ideological communist thinking that laid the basis for their revolution to begin with. And I think that realization is causing China to very rapidly shift its orientation in terms of geopolitics.
Caleb Maupin, thank you for your time. I know you got to run. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Jim Kavanaugh, your final thoughts on this point.
Well, yeah, I think part of what's going on in Hong Kong is directed towards Taiwan and towards, again, increasing the increasing the resistance to Taiwan ever being or Hong Kong ever being really reabsorbed into the mainland. It's neocolonialism, and it's one of the reasons behind this all. Also, again, is the INF Treaty, and renouncing that is about putting thousands of intermediate missiles around China to prevent the rise of China as a military and economic power in the West in the Pacific.
Daniel Lazar.
I agree with both Caleb and Jim. I think the U.S. is pressing its offensive against China. America is, you know, it sees itself as a global empire, but there's a growing axis of resistance involving countries like Russia, China, Syria, Iran, and these are formidable countries. So the U.S. is trying to contain this international resistance. It's flailing about, not doing a very good job, and I think it ultimately will fail.
And Daniel, you know, to that point, I think what a lot of people in this country are missing is that the nature of empire, particularly those empires that are based upon militarism, the nature of warfare has changed. It's gone from symmetrical to asymmetrical. And so now you don't need the aircraft carriers. You don't need the F-18. You don't need the B-1 bomber. The non-state actors, it's no longer the blue uniform versus the green uniform or the yellow uniform versus the red uniform. You can now inflict your will or extract your ounce of pain through asymmetrical tactics. And so, to a great degree, the billions and trillions that we're spending, it's not nearly making us as safe as we think it is.
Yes, I agree. But you have to remember that I mean, military science, weaponry, et cetera, is always dynamic. It's been dynamic since the ancient world, the invention of the chariot. And it's always changing. The game is always changing. And the U.S. has invested hundreds of billions in aircraft carriers.
Oh, yeah.
And now those aircraft carriers are mainly just like big fat targets for Iranian missiles.
My point is, look at today and what one guy with a fake pressure cooker did in New York City. That's my point, is that I realize what an ultrasonic nuclear powered ballistic missile can do. But look at now what a pressure cooker can do when it's placed in a train station. That's my point.
Yes, but no country, every attempt to conquer the world has failed.
Oh, right.
And the latest attempt will fail, too. And
you are correct.
It is failing now before our very eyes.
Daniel Lazar, thank you very much. Jim Kavanaugh, as always, thank you very much. Caleb Maupin, I know you're gone. Thank you. Hey, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. On Monday, we discussed Yemeni separatists over the weekend having seized key government and military posts in Aden, the de facto capital, raising the prospect of the South seceding. The power grab carried out by UAE-backed forces calls into question the unity and purpose of the Gulf Arab Coalition in Yemen, which was launched in 2015 to restore the Yemeni government to power and roll back gains made by the Houthis. Yesterday on Capitol Hill, there was a vigil in honor of the 41 Yemeni students that were killed August 9th of last year in Sada'a, Yemen, by an American-made bomb. My guest was instrumental in planning that vigil. She is the executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities. She is Mac Hamilton, and as always, Mac, great to have you. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Talk to us about the vigil and connect the vigil to current events in Yemen.
Sure. So the vigil yesterday was hosted by STAND and many of our partners, including Action Corps, Code Pink, Peace Action, and Just Foreign Policy, many of the groups who have been working to try to end the U.S. role in the killing that's been happening in Yemen since about 2015. And so we, as a student and youth-led organization, felt that it was important to lift the names of the children who were killed in the bombing last August, particularly because it was a U.S.-made bomb made by Lockheed Martin. And we wanted to make sure to remember the names and lives of those children who were killed. It's an important moment as well in terms of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is set to be voted on hopefully next month. And we're working to ensure that there be a few different pieces on ending the U.S. role in Yemen's war in that piece of legislation.
How do you see this most recent story from Monday about what's going on in Yemen now?
Sure. I mean, I think that it speaks to the fact that the coalition is fracturing a bit. Saudi and the UAE, while they've been working together since 2015, have slightly different interests and different approaches to the conflict. So especially in the south, which has only been part of a unified Yemen since 1990, the Southern Transitional Council, the separatists there, are backed by the UAE, and Saudi Arabia prefers to see a unified Yemen under President Hadi, who is in exile in Saudi Arabia. So we're seeing further fracturing. I think, honestly, this is what many are calling a war within a war, and it only means death and more injuries and difficulties for civilians living on the ground, particularly in Aden and southern Yemen.
Is the war within a war the result of Houthis making gains? And because they're making gains, they're putting pressure on the coalition?
I would actually say that this is a bit separate. The Houthis are largely operating in the north of Yemen, and the south of Yemen has its own history and grievances and have had separatist forces for many, many years. So I would say the ethnic and religious makeups of both the north and south are a bit different. So would caution against kind of tying the two together too closely.
So August 9th, the Saudis dropped the American-made bomb, killing these children. They hit a school bus. And we thought then that that was going to be a turning point in terms of American perception of what's going on, you know, very similar to kind of the shootings in this country where the latest atrocity, everyone thinks that that's going to be the one to be the turning point. But in Yemen, that horrific act did not result in the change in policy that people thought it would. What do you think is going to have to happen in this country in order for Americans or our politicians to really start to see this is A, a no-win situation, and B, asking ourselves, why would we want as a country to be involved in such a horrific, horrific activity?
Sure. I mean, I think the majority of the American people do believe that, and the majority of our legislators also do. So after this attack, you know, a few months after in December, we were able to pass the War Powers Resolution through both chambers of Congress, which is the first time that that has happened since the Vietnam War. So I would say that it is the will of the American people and of Congress that the U.S. stop its destructive role in this war. Unfortunately, Trump was able to veto that legislation, and Congress could not overturn that veto. They didn't have a supermajority.
And that's really the basis of my question. I agree with everything that you said, but after Trump vetoed the legislation, there was no significant backlash. That was really what I was getting to. And the United States is still providing a logistic information, still refueling planes. That was my point.
Sure. So kind of going off of that, you're completely correct in terms of there being some high hurdles to jump here when it comes to next steps. Congress did put out resolutions of disapproval in terms of Trump's emergency arms sales. Congress had put an informal hold on arms sales, particularly for the most destructive types of weapons that are being used to harm civilians. And a few months ago, Trump did declare those emergency arms sales, and there were congressional resolutions of disapproval around those. Again, there was not a supermajority, and therefore he has been able to veto those resolutions of disapproval and pass those resolutions in order to continue to sell arms using Iran as the reason for the emergency. So that leaves us at the NDAA as our most likely tool to be able to end the U.S. role in the war, which is why we were hosting this vigil alongside a lobby day with our student leaders to talk to Congress about the importance of ending this war. So there are three different Yemen-related amendments that we're backing in the NDAA, which is a must-pass piece of legislation related to U.S. defense and military, and we are backing those amendments in order to end the war, and that is our best hope at the moment to creating a better life for Yemenis on the ground.
Mac Hamilton, Executive Manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities. As always, Mac, thank you so much for your time, so much for your work, and greatly appreciated and look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much, Wilmer.
Thank you. All right, folks, you know, selling aircraft to Saudi Arabia, selling $8 billion worth of fighter jets to Taiwan, there's got to be a better way than just selling weapons of mass destruction. All right, folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.